Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
Well, everyone is certainly consumed with the upcoming election, and that is always the case as we fall into these election years and people get consumed with all the different two-party politics that they're shoving in your face and all the different distraction stories they're using to keep you on task. So tomorrow, without a doubt, I will be doing my election show, I guess you can call it, where I'm going to continue to focus on why I think we should be abstaining from this illegitimate election system that we have and all the many different reasons why that's very obvious from the election, from the voting machines to the system itself from top to bottom. So you can look forward to that tomorrow as well. Make sure you check out the interview I just did with Pamela Bennett, the woman who was on the hunger strike to draw attention to what's going on in Yemen, as well as the interview I did with Whitney Webb recently on Yemen, in addition to that, which is one of the big stories I want to get into today, is the lie that's being told about this ceasefire that's supposedly going to be happening in 30 days. We also have a lot of interesting things to talk about today in regard to some new superpower opiate, because that's what we need during an opiate crisis, as well as Israel's aggressive invasion of U.S. politics in general, which many are already aware of, but these statistics will probably blow your mind. So for the first story of the day, one that you know is very important to me, what's going on in Yemen, but more so about how the U.S. is now seemingly aggressively lying to cover up possibly an attack that we're seeing take place right now. This coming from antiwar.com, entitled, 2 days after U.S. call for ceasefire, Saudis pound Yemen. And this is something that I hope we can continue to put out there, because this is what seems to always happen when they pretend to want some kind of a ceasefire. Now, ultimately, earlier this week, as we reported then, Defense Secretary James Mattis called for an immediate ceasefire in Yemen. Now, in the course of this, he demanded an end to the fighting, to an immediate halt to all airstrikes against populated areas. Except, to the surprise of no one paying attention, as this is the usual way of things, yesterday in Yemen was much like any other day, with Saudi warplanes endlessly bombing areas in and around the northern cities of Hodeidah and Sana'a. Heavy airstrikes were reported particularly around Sana'a Airport, which is a heavily civilian-populated area. And as I pointed out at the time on the last show we did, Hussein al-Bughaidi drew this attention just before I went live with the other show, pointing out that while they're talking about ceasefire and peace talks, Saudi Arabia is carrying out a massive airstrike on Sana'a Airport with over 20 strikes. And again, this is something that we see regularly happen, where Pompeo will stand with Saudi Arabia and say, we back them, we know they're trying not to do these things, and literally as they're saying that, they bomb another bus full of children. This is the way of it. And it's important that we begin to recognize this. Now, the Sana'a was mostly hit with airstrikes, while local reports, basic heavy clashes around Hodeidah, which as I pointed out is a very vital port city that Saudi forces have been massing around all week. It's their focal point, and the U.S. as well. Now, in no case is there any indication that a ceasefire is starting whatsoever or even on the table, especially with the recent influx of an additional 10,000 U.S.-backed coalition fighters on the ground. Doesn't seem like at all something they're preparing for. Now, Saudi and UAE officials have yet to comment on the U.S. call for a ceasefire and peace talks at all. The only response at all has been from their camp was essentially from Yemeni officials backed by the Saudis who embraced the idea of peace talks, all, you know, but similarly showed no signs of stopping any fighting in the meantime. Now, these are the supposed legitimate leaders of Yemen that no one in Yemen supports that are backed by the United States and their empire, that they were originally put in place with a U.S.-backed coup. So the same thing we're seeing in South America and all over the world, where they're putting in place someone they can control. And then when the people, the popular movement, pushes them out, they then say, they're the problem and we need to go in and reinstall the legitimate leader. Legitimate in whose eyes is a good question. Now, even as this is all happening, as they continue to force the idea of peace talks and ceasefires in general, we're now seeing even today, again, Hussein put out a tweet saying, in the last 48 hours, the coalition has conducted the largest attack with 100-plus strikes on Hodeidah Airport, Kilo 16 area, and main road between Hodeidah and Sana'a City. According to Houthi sources, 64 armored and non-armored vehicles destroyed. 113 coalition-backed forces were killed. Now, this is currently ongoing while they're talking about ceasefire. Now, you could make the argument that they're doing this independent of the U.S. talks, and that's certainly possible. But as Hussein predicted, and I'll leave this tweet in the show notes as well, days before this, that a major attack would happen following the proposed ceasefire. He says to Hussein al-Bukhari, who I've had on the show, for he's brought in Yemen at the moment, has said without fail, every single time they release a statement about peace talks or ceasefires, it's followed by a massive attack and bombing campaign. That he's point blank saying that it's always a cover for the attack. So that they would put this out knowing that the point was to cover the attack that was planned, knowing the integral role that the United States plays in Saudi affairs on the ground in Yemen, it's impossible to think that they weren't aware that these attacks were going to take place. And many of the major military moves by the U.S.-backed coalition that have taken place over the years this war has been going on, the invasion, under the false pretense of a ceasefire, they've always been carried out. And the ceasefire has been put out by the United States, saying we're looking for ceasefires and peace talks, and then while these happen, some of the most major offensives in this war have taken place. So it seems like this is the usual way. Pretend to talk about ceasefire, pretend to talk about peace talks, and carry out a large offensive. So you take that for what you will. The history is very plain. But nonetheless, we're seeing the same thing carried out. We can only wonder how many more people will die before this 30-day period is up, knowing full well that all they have to do is stop supporting it. Like Whitney Webb said in her interview, whether we're talking about U.S. or U.K., they could pull the plug on this war immediately and it would be over. But they're not. And that's what we have to look at. Now, in a related story from MiddleEastMonitor.com, this one in regard to Netanyahu specifically, entitled Netanyahu Asked U.S. to Stand by MBS After Khashoggi Murder. Very revealing. Now, this whole episode today is going to be very interlinked between the new little trifecta of evil we see developing between the U.S. oligarchy, Saudi Arabia authoritarian monarchy, and the Zionist false state of Israel. Now, they're all very clearly connected with their aggression towards Iran, what's going on in Yemen, even Syria, lots of what we're seeing. It's all interconnected, especially in regard to Israel's larger idea for the greater Israel plan, all the different things that they want to accomplish. Now, in this story, Netanyahu asked the U.S. to stand by Mohammed bin Salman after the murder. Now, just let that kind of resonate with what they're saying there, that what happened, they're saying stand by him regardless. When this kind of things come out, we have to recognize the true nature of this. It wasn't like they were going back and forth over the fact, what should we think, who should we believe? They knew they were going to stand by him from the beginning. Now, it's been revealed that through Jared Kushner and John Bolton, no surprise there, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, asked the United States, point blank, to stand by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, even after the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And clearly, he has. Well, several world leaders have shunned the Crown Prince and called for a halt on arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and an end to the U.S.-backed Yemen genocide, Trump has supported the Saudi version of events and refused to sanction the kingdom. Understand, this is today, now, while we know now that it was premeditated murder, as they've admitted, that they lied three different times about the story. They've admitted to getting rid of his body with a foreign collaborator. This is all truth, fact, backed up by the Saudis' own admission. And yet now we still see that they're choosing to ignore any action against them for what they admitted they have done. We've been saying that was what was going to happen from the very beginning. Those that have watched this show, we knew that Trump's been very clear about not wanting to hurt his arms sales with Saudi Arabia. But now it comes clear that Israel reached out and said, make sure you back him regardless of what happens. Now, Israel and Saudi Arabia have collaborated in targeting dissidents more than once. Now, in October, it emerged that Saudi Arabia had used Israeli technology to spy on Saudi dissident Omar Abdulaziz in Canada. Omar Abdulaziz in Canada. Saudi reportedly used Israel's, I think it's called Pegasus software, to tap Abdulaziz's iPhone after having previously threatened to arrest his entire family if he didn't stop writing about the kingdom's conflict with Canada. So you can see a very clear connection to the kind of thing we're talking about here with what happened with Jamal Khashoggi. Now, we're never going to fully know the full story because they don't want us to. But understand that this is a long-term connection between the three in this little axis we're looking at here and how they've planned to not do anything about these kind of stories. Whether Khashoggi was meant to be a distraction or not, it very clearly shows us they're willingly disregarding the truth about the kind of people that the U.S. oligarchy is supporting because of personal reasons, financial reasons. Has nothing to do with human rights or what's morally correct, despite all of the claims to the contrary. Now, in a related story in regard to Israel, and this is one that I think is an incredibly important story for Americans, understanding the kind of influence we can see Netanyahu waging over Trump, but in regard to Congress. This coming from Mint Press News, and these stats are shocking. This entitled, Midterm Scoreboard Reveals Massive Influence of Pro-Israel PACs on Congressional Candidates. Now, the idea of PACs and super PACs and the way that they affect our political system is atrocious. These elite groupings of money that could be basically legal bribery for politicians is what we're talking about here. And this now is showing us that it is massively, massively controlled by Israel. Not much of a surprise for many people. Now, simply pointing out this obvious glaring truth is probably anti-Semitic in today's backward world, but we're going to talk about it anyway. Now, a just released midterm election scoreboard shows that Israel partisans have dominated Congress over the past 10 years, despite the preference of American voters, who consistently wish for even-handed policies and feel that the U.S. gives Israel far too much money, $10.5 million a day, in fact. Now, the detailed scoreboard on candidates for the Senate and House of Representatives shows that 28 pro-Israel PACs and numerous pro-Israel individuals have given candidates millions of dollars in campaign contributions. The scoreboard presents, 29 bills and resolutions that were introduced on behalf of Israel, some openly drafted by AIPAC, literally having the lobbyists literally create the bills that they then give to the politicians. And they then pass. American politicians, mind you. Just think about what that would mean if that was a Russian lobbyist group. Now, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee is the one we're talking about here, AIPAC. This is a massive Israeli lobbying group. And understand, lobbying is paying these politicians, giving them money for their campaigns, and they clearly expect something in return. Passing these bills, for instance. Now, 20 have passed into law, or are on record statement, many are by unanimous consent, largely when they're supporting Israel. The legislation has accrued a total of over 3,300 co-sponsors. Now, five pieces of legislation in the study addressed military aid to Israel, including the memo of understanding, the MOU, that President Obama signed, promising Israel $38 billion over the next 10 years. A bill currently before Congress cements this non-binding agreement into law. So it clearly crosses over from Obama to Trump, and it's much larger than any puppet president that's in place supporting Israel. Now, this is, understand, many aren't even aware of this, the largest such aid package in U.S. history, and an amount greater than U.S. military aid to all other countries in the world combined. Like, take that in. What they're giving Israel is larger than every other U.S. military aid package to every other country in the world combined. That's profound. Now, American taxpayers presently provide nearly a quarter of Israel's annual defense budget. Your tax dollars, if you're an American, are providing a quarter of Israel's annual defense budget. Also staggering. 6 in 10 Americans feel that that's too much. In this wonderful democracy we live in, where the people's opinion matter, but 6 in 10, that seems like a majority. I wonder why nothing's happening. Interesting. Now, six pieces of legislation grant congressional support to Israel's right to self-defense against the unarmed enclave of Gaza or the Palestinians in Jerusalem. Six others took a stand against actions of the United Nations, which sought to safeguard Palestinian rights. An additional four supported the erosion of American rights to free speech. Understand what that's saying. These are bills supported, in many ways written completely by AIPAC, that are supporting the erosion of American rights to free speech. Why would Israel want to attack America's free speech? I mean, many of you likely know the answer to that question, but just asking that question is hopefully something that's going to shake people free of the ridiculous propaganda we're seeing today. Why would Israel care at all about your right to free speech? Now, an overwhelming majority of the incumbents running for re-election voted for the pro-Israel legislations and signed the pro-Israel letters. Now, 13 senators and 14 representatives received money and or endorsements from five or more pro-Israel PACs. Five or more. It's crazy. Over 80 congressional challengers have also accepted donations from at least one pro-Israel PAC, most from more than one. Now, according to Open Secrets, which is the group we're discussing here, there are currently 28 pro-Israel PACs, groups, organizations, 28 pro-Israel groups that are designed to lobby politicians to support Israeli whatever bill they're trying to pass that supports Israel. These groups are, their entire job is to pay politicians to get them to vote their way. That's what lobbying is. Now, unlike most PACs, which announce their focus in their name, most of these pro-Israel PACs use names that disguise their focus. Wonder why? Such as Americans United in Support of Democracy, Americans for Good Government, and Because We Care. Understand, a group called Americans United in Support of Democracy is in fact an extremely pro-Israel PAC designed to lobby politicians to support Israeli policy. But it's called Americans United in Support of Democracy. Just think of that. How easily people are manipulated if they don't simply know where to look. Now, the scoreboard indicates that a substantial number of the 410 incumbents on the ballot in both houses voted pro-Israel most of the time. 355 members of Congress, 87%, mind you, had a pro-Israel score of over 70%. Congress considered only one piece of explicitly pro-Palestine legislation during the entire decade this was looked at. Representative Betty McCollum offered H.R. 4391 called No Way to Treat a Child, which, of course, garnered just 7% of congressional backing, only 29 people. No Way to Treat a Child challenges Israel's illegal practice of detaining, interrogating, and torturing Palestinian children. Part of the brutal military occupation that has been ongoing for over half a century. So, in the words of No Way to Treat a Child campaign, quote, Israel has the dubious distinction of being the only country in the world that systematically prosecutes between 500 and 700 children in military courts every year. Again, in spite of this documented just disregard for international humanitarian law, on the part of Israel specifically, only 29 members of Congress, 7%, have signed for H.R. 4391. Because why would we care how a child's treated? The entire bill is about saying Israel shouldn't be able to detain, interrogate, and torture children. And the vast majority of Congress goes, nah, that's nothing we want to sign. It's against Israel, then no go. Just think about that. Why would only 7% of Congress, why would the rest of Congress think that not signing a bill that would save children's lives is the way to go? I mean, I just can't wrap my mind around that. And the only way to look at this is because it's something that goes against the wishes of Israel, the groups that fund our politicians, apparently predominantly. Just absolutely staggering. The same reason people will pass a bill about not murdering children in Yemen and it gets basically zero support, because it doesn't support the people that are paying for their entire run. This is how this stuff works. Hopefully those numbers stick through and hopefully people will look into this and spread the information that our American political system is completely invaded and hijacked by the Zionist false state of Israel. Hopefully that can begin to get out. We'll see. Moving on to the next story coming from Mint Press News in regard to more domestic policy or domestic slash foreign policy, but also in relation to more Israel influence. This entitled Trump's Rules of Engagement for Troops at U.S.-Mexico Border Mirror Those Used by the IDF in Gaza. That sounds fantastic. What would we want more than to look exactly like the IDF dealing with people coming across the border. Well, this is exactly what we're having now. Now, on Thursday afternoon, Trump detailed in a speech, which many of you are probably already familiar with, that, quote, anybody in the caravan throwing stones, rocks, like they did to Mexico and the Mexican military, Mexican police, where they badly hurt police and soldiers of Mexico, we will consider that a firearm. He then elaborated that, quote, we will consider it the stone throwing, the maximum that we can consider that. We're not going to put up with that. They want to throw rocks at our military fights back. I told them to consider it a rifle. Now, of course, some Mexican law enforcement officers were injured by stone throwers that he's referring to, but there were no fatalities, no severe injuries incurred by the Mexican authorities. And it's obviously not the same as he tried to make it as being hit by a rock, as being shot by a gun. But that's, and this is not putting influence on one side or the other's argument, because it's a very emotional argument. People reflexively lash out emotionally when they feel people don't agree with their side of this kind of a topic. Just stating the facts. Now, Trump's announcement caused considerable outrage, interestingly, among some U.S. veterans, with some calling these new rules of engagement a war crime in the making. However, it has long been the standard in countries like Israel, where the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, have used stone throwing as a pretext to disperse riots, as well as peaceful protests with live ammunition. And what does this bring to light or to mind? The idea of the agent provocateur, something we've written about many times that we should be well aware of. It's very easy to put someone in place to throw stones, to carry out something provocative, so they then can react and shut it down and put all the blame on the people they put in place to carry this out. Does it always happen? Of course not. Could it happen? Does it happen? Absolutely. Verifiably so. And that's important for us to understand how easy it is to put someone in place to carry out something like this. Same thing we see in protests in the United States. These provocative groups come screaming through, throwing fire, breaking windows, and then they have the ability to shut down the entire protest, even though they weren't the ones that did it. That's how this stuff operates. Now, nowhere has this manipulation, where we're talking about with provocateurs and many other things, and, you know, just unjustified force, been more true than in the IDF's response to the Great Return March in Gaza. And at least 210 unarmed Palestinians have been killed, at least, since the protest began, and over 22,000 have been injured, many of them shot by IDF soldiers, unarmed. Many of those shot and killed by the IDF in Gaza were not even engaged in throwing stones. That's important to understand. We have it on video, people just standing there waving a flag. Now, while others were not even protesters, but instead medics, journalists, even just children. In contrast, only one IDF soldier has been killed during the nearly 8 months of the Great Return March. The tone of Netanyahu's rhetoric has made little or no distinction between Gazans and African migrants, with the Israeli leader having called both illegal infiltrators, which I noted on in a past show, that threatens Israel's status as a Jewish ethnostate. Such remarks are similar to those voiced by Trump, who warned earlier this year that illegal immigrants from Central America sought to, quote, pour into and infest our country. Now, there's logic to many sides of these arguments. But the reality here is that we're very quickly becoming everything that we see we don't like about Israel. All of the aggressive way. I mean, the concept that they use the word infiltrator for any kind of an immigrant. Now, if the United States is shifting away from liking immigration at all, which it seems like today, that's up for the masses to decide in this faux democracy we have. But the reality is this country was founded on the concept of immigration, the melting pot that we pride ourselves on, that the mainstream media still pretends is something that makes America so great and strong. But yet now we're at this point where people have been manipulated into seeing this as every single one of these people as a problem, which is simply not the case. It needs to be dealt with appropriately. I mean, people that are making this happen also need to be dealt with. But the reality here is that this is shooting people for throwing stones. Look, the United States, with its false moral superiority of the day, if we actually want to be the kind of thing they're projecting, we need to be better. We can't just say, well, they're throwing stones, just shoot them because they're doing something wrong. We need to be actually better than that. Actually be the country that says, no, we're not just going to kill people because they're trying to come into our country because we destroyed theirs. It's baffling to me that people are now okay with this. And it's a testament to the propaganda and the social engineering that is truly, truly manipulating the I guess, the popular group think, the people that scream the loudest, which may not actually be the majority today, which I'm beginning to see more and more of. But they're the ones definitely out there screaming at the rallies and doing everything they can to draw all their attention to themselves, which usually is a sign that they're not as well informed. But that's my opinion. Now, as the author notes, with the U.S. establishing such IDF-style rules of engagement against unarmed individuals, several consequences are likely to result. First, it will further legitimize Israel's brutal repression of protests in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Second, allowing U.S. soldiers to shoot at unarmed civilians sets a dangerous precedent for future government responses to domestic unrest, both at the border and within the country, as well as advancing the disturbing trend whereby the line between the military and domestic police force has been increasingly blurred. Third, as in Gaza, many desperate and helpless people are likely to die. Potentially people that are just there trying to actually come through the right way and got caught up in all this mess. We just pretend like that's not the case. Everybody in Gaza is a terrorist. Every single one of people in this caravan are all terrorist, Middle Eastern, South, you know, just all this hyperbole. Not every single one of these people are a problem. It needs to be dealt with in a way that potentially poses a potential danger. But the way that people are going over the top is very alarming. Now, understand, like I've pointed out many times, if this was Obama, all the very same people that are currently blindly supporting Donald Trump in this would be freaking out about everything we just talked about. The dangerous precedent for militarizing the border, martial law. But now just because it's Trump there, they see it differently. That has to show us something. Now, given that the U.S. government is well aware that the migrant caravan poses very little threat, ultimately, and that most of its members are unlikely to even make it to the U.S. border, a dangerous motive behind Trump's new rules of engagement and considerable militarization of the U.S. border appears to be the green lighting the U.S. military to function as an IDF-style military police force whenever the next threat emerges, whether it be foreign invaders or internal enemies. And I completely agree with her statement right there. Absolutely 100%. The point that, you know, regardless of the potential danger of what this caravan may present, because I can acknowledge that there could be something, but it be very clearly being used to set the precedent to carry this out in the future against possibly us next time. So think about that. For the next story coming from Zero Hedge, another interesting story in regard to Netanyahu's statements on Khashoggi, which are kind of staggering now after it's all come out, but this entitled Israel Breaks Silence, Khashoggi Murder, Horrendous, but Iran the bigger problem. Of course, right? It was terrible they murdered that person, but just Iran. Right? Just Iran. That's how it always goes. There's no real substance to what they say. Fomenting terrorism around the world, blah. They just throw these talking points out with nothing to back them up. But we have Saudi Arabia murdering somebody on Turkish soil. We have them committing open genocide in Yemen, but Iran's the problem. This is what they want you to think, and this is a very frustrating development. Now, Netanyahu argued in public statements this week that while the killing of the Saudi journalist at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul was horrendous, stability in Saudi Arabia is vital to global security, whatever that means. However, Saudi Arabia somehow is now vital to global security is beyond me. He said, quote, what happened in the Istanbul consulate was horrendous and it should be duly dealt with. But so I guess the dealt with is just for them to decide and we all just move on down the road. He goes on to say, yet at the same time, I say that it's very important for the stability of the world and the region. End of the world that Saudi Arabia remains stable, repeated himself in there. Now, he stresses that, of course, the larger problem is Iran, that blocking Iranian terrorism is imperative for the security of Europe. But ask him to, you know, gesture towards one of the incidences of such an event. No, you know, they do it, though. We know we've got intelligence that we can't share. Blocking Iran, he says, is utmost in our agenda for security. It's so blatantly obvious their aggression towards Iran. That's always been the plan. It's been the plan for decades that we've verifiably talked about for years now. It didn't just all of a sudden stumble into being the point. They've been planning this. We've proven that. And so they continue to redirect you at Iran. Just this bland talking points to Iran's the bad guy. Don't forget that. Ignore Saudi Arabia as they behead people and crucify people and murder journalists and commit genocide. But just Iran. Have to see this. It's just so frustrating that people can continue to buy this stuff. So now, in what, you know, should be an entirely expected turn of events, both Trump and the U.S. oligarchy and the Netanyahu and the Israeli Zionist regime are completely standing by Saudi Arabia and MBS. After everything that we know, that is enough for many people to wake up, to realize that regardless of all the admissions they've made, everything that we know happened, by their own admission, they're now blindly standing with Saudi Arabia regardless. That's got to show you something. For the final story of the day in regard to some domestic policy that I found just astounding. This is really shocking to me. Not because they did it. This is exactly what I expect them to do, but that they did it now. After all of the ridiculous talk about fighting the opioid crisis and how important this is to everybody, turns out, oh, FDA approves a drug 10 times stronger than the deadly fentanyl, because that's what we need in an opiate crisis. That makes sense. While they continue to drag their feet and ignore all the natural potential possibilities, just make something worse, dangerous, stronger, more addictive, and put it out there. I mean, how much more do we really need to see from these people to know that they really don't care about what's best for you? So the FDA has approved the rollout of a new opioid drug that is up to 1,000 times stronger than morphine. Despite the opioid crisis that's currently killing more Americans than any other cause of, you know, accidental death, as the statement goes. But it's accidental is quite debatable in this discussion point. Now, the agency cited with its advisory panel, which voted 10-3 to approve Dysuvia, which is what it's called, a sublingual tablet form of sufentanil. It basically goes under your tongue against the recommendation of their chairman. At 5-10 times the strength of fentanyl, sufentanil is 500-1,000 times stronger than morphine and will supposedly only be administered to treat acute pain in medically supervised settings. Of course, right? That's how it always works out. Thank you so much for the super chat, Nino. Free Palestine, absolutely. But of course, right? That's only for medically supervised, as everything was supposed to be before this. And as the author rightly points out, fentanyl, too, is available only by prescription, yet a significant quantity is manufactured in illegal labs or diverted right onto the streets by the people supposed to be keeping this locked up, where it regularly kills opioid addicts who aren't even aware they're taking it. Dysuvia is fulfilling an unmet need, according to Dr. Pamela Palmer, chief medical officer at ACELRX, or ASLRX, however, keep an eye on that name so you know who to speak out about. And she said, this ultimately is the group making this drug, but they said because the drug dissolves under patients' tongues, it provides quick relief without the use of an injection. This is basically, in my eyes, a way to just make this immediately go into the bloodstream and get people more high, is what it seems like. And that's exactly what drug addicts are out to find. That's why they made these pills where they can't be snorted, because people will go out and do this because they're trying to get the fastest high with these drugs. So to make something that can be just immediately dissolved into the tongue, it's like they're literally setting it up perfectly to be abused, but they probably are. Now, because it must be delivered in a medical setting, they claim, and doctors and nurses are trained to give injections, there are relatively few situations in which it offers an advantage that outweighs the risk of unleashing a powerful new narcotic onto an already drug-saturated populace. And I agree with that completely. The idea is that if it's only going to be in a medical setting and the injection is just as quick, why create this entire new drug, which this is just wildly dangerous for addiction, that ultimately serves not much versus the tongue or the injection. It just doesn't make any sense. And all the things we could be putting our money and time into, all the things we actually need to help and solve and cure, but no, they want to make a slightly better drug that's much stronger. Now, interestingly, but not surprising, the Department of Defense, revealingly, also had a hand in funding the research that produced Dysuvia. The Department of Defense, which they say could replace morphine on the battlefield due to its ease of administration. But, I mean, understand that the idea of morphine on the battlefield as we're going towards a war time that is much more robotic and you know, all the ways of trying to make it seem like it's less dangerous for humans. And yet we're now talking about creating an entire drug funded by the Department of Defense, which makes it immediately dissolvable into the body. Now, Acel Rx projects $1.1 billion in annual sales and hopes to have its product on hospital shelves by early 2019. Perfect. So for the Department of Defense's concern, they can addict more veterans to the drugs they want to hold them to, which is one of the biggest issues with veterans, among many. Now, with 200 million prescriptions already written for opioids every year in the U.S., and that's legal prescriptions, mind you, many argue Americans simply don't need another drug. God damn it, if we don't think that, it's amazing that we think we need any more at all. Dr. Sidney Wolf, senior advisor to Public Citizens Health Research Group, dismisses Palmer's claims about the fast action Dysuvia. Two studies indicated patients only felt meaningful pain relief after 54 minutes and 78 minutes, making the new drug no better than swallowing a pill. So right there, boom. Right out the window, all their claims of the immediate, you know, that their study shows that it might as well be a pill. So this has nothing to do with actually being better for you. Thank you so much for your super chat, Kimberly. I appreciate it. And, you know, despite all this information, knowing that it's just as good as anything, it's not as, you know, more efficient, they're fast tracking it anyway. This highly addictive and wildly dangerous drug, while keeping other much more safe natural drugs completely illegal. But I wonder why. Over 72,000 Americans died of drug overdoses last year. That's a new record. And among the drugs causing overdose, the largest increase was in fentanyl and fentanyl-like synthetics, exactly like the one we're talking about. Just let that sink in. 72,000 Americans. And yet we're still allowing them to make these drugs, put them on the market, but promise that it'll be different this time. We need to see the reality of the situation. As I wrote in an article a while back, the orchestrated addiction of the masses, the sweeping epidemic affecting you and your children. I wrote this years ago, before people were talking about it, before Hillary said the silent epidemic, as if we weren't screaming at the top of our lungs about how this is ruining our country. We need to see what they're trying to accomplish here. Drugged up, dumbed down, blind, hypnotized populace. But get out there and vote for one of your two parties. They want you hypnotized. They want you blind to the reality of the situation. But those of you that watch this show, hopefully you get a little insight into the reality of the world. At least trigger some thought to go out there and do things for yourself, to research for yourself. Thank you, James, for your super chat as well. I appreciate all of your support today. I'll be definitely tuning in tomorrow for sure for a lot of information about the elections and their fraudulent ways, because it's important to discuss that at a time when we're being, you know, we've never been more important to vote, they say every single year, and nothing ever changes. But we're going to change that because we're going to change things. The people are going to change things, and we don't need them to do it. Thank you for tuning in today. There won't be an R&R, unfortunately. I'm still kind of trying to recover here. I had a little bit of a setback with my after surgery. Still had to deal with this thing. So on Monday, I should be free and clear of all of the after effects of my surgery. But I appreciate all of your support and everybody that's been reaching out and saying kind things. So make sure you tune in tomorrow and make sure you check out all of our interviews that I've recently put up. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
Now, I know that standards have slipped over the last few years in Washington, but for a lawyer, you're remarkably cavalier with any idea of justice.